Thanks for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. The U.S. calls radiation levels in Japan extremely high. This morning, the Japanese military used helicopters to dump seawater onto the heavily damaged Fukushima power plant. The U.S. government has told Americans to stay at least 50 miles away because of radiation threats. Japan's worsening nuclear crisis is fueling new concerns over just how safe nuclear energy is in the U.S. and throughout the world. Joining me to talk about the effects on the nuclear industry, Ellen Vanko of the Union of Concerned Scientists, Charles Ferguson of the Federation of American Scientists, and Angie Howard. She's a former Nuclear Energy Institute executive. Throughout the hour, I'll look forward to hearing your comments and questions. You can join us by phone on 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Join us on Facebook or send us a tweet. Good morning to all of you. Thank you for being here.
Good morning. Good morning, Diane.
Charles Ferguson, I'll start with you. Explain to us what's happening there at the inside the nuclear reactors at the Fukushima site.
Diane, it's very complicated. We need to understand this is the largest nuclear complex in the world. If you look at the Fukushima power plants, there are basically two power plants. There are six reactors at the Daiichi facility, and that's the one that's undergoing the greatest concerns and the greatest damage. And then there's a neighboring facility at Daini, where there are some other reactors as well. So if you add up all the reactors there, it is the largest in the world. What we saw end of last week, Friday, when the earthquake struck, things happened as they should have happened at a nuclear facility. What I mean by that is the seismometers at the nuclear plant registered a ground shaking above the safety threshold. That sent a signal to the operating reactors to shut down. Control rods were inserted. The plant shut down properly, as far as we understand. Then about an hour later, the tsunami came in. It was this 1-2 punch. And that's when the troubles started to begin, because then the plant lost both off-site power and on-site emergency diesel generator power. People need to understand, if they're not nuclear engineers and nuclear physicists,
that as I am not.
Even though the plant was shut down,
right.
There's still a lot of decay heat that has to be removed from the reactor cores. So the first reactor operates at 460 megawatts of electrical power. And when that was shut down, the power level immediately after shutdown was about 6% of that 460 megawatts. It's still a lot of power that's being generated. That decays over time. So right now we're in a race, they're in a race against time to try to get the cooling under control, and the decay level keeps dropping, but it stays pretty intense for several days, if not more than a week or two, until you can get it to the point where you can actually control things, where we prevent the risk of a full meltdown of those cores.
Now, what about this dumping of seawater on these nuclear reactors?
Well, this is, you kind of run out of options, and you want to still keep cooling on these cores. And at that point, of course, then the reactors are a loss, and you're just trying to protect public health and safety to try to get those vents under control. So they've been directing seawater through fire hoses and now helicopters dumping down into some of the reactors, into spent fuel pools as well, because that's another concern. I think people may think, well, we just have to deal with the reactor cores. But it could get worse than that, because there are these spent fuel pools at the reactor core sites that contain several core loads of radioactive material. So if you want to speculate about a worst-case event, it could be the spent fuel pools get drained of water, the zirconium cladding in the spent fuel catches fire, and if you don't have a containment to hold that radioactive material in, the fire could disperse radioactive material.
Charles Ferguson, he's president of the Federation of American Scientists and author of the upcoming book, Nuclear Energy, What Everyone Needs to Know. Turning to you, Ellen Vanko, in a House subcommittee meeting on Wednesday, Energy Secretary Stephen Chu said even he is confused about the threat level in Japan. How do you read it?
I think right now we are hoping for better information than we've been getting from the Japanese government. The information that's going to the administration is in some form being conveyed to the American public, whether it's going to the administration, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. The Nuclear Regulatory Commission sent an entire team of people there a day or so ago that it's not clear how close, whether they're on the ground, because it's not clear who can be on the ground at this point, given the radiation releases we're hearing about. So just the inability to be on site and know what's going on will affect our ability to know what's going on. And so I think Secretary Chu is correct to state he doesn't know, but I'm not sure the Japanese government knows everything. And if they do, we're not sure they're telling us.
So are you equally confused about the width and breadth of the threat level?
UCS has some very good scientists that are experienced in plant operations and nuclear safety, and they have been taking the data that is available to us and analyzing it and sending out the information to reporters and talking to the media and trying to keep people up to date on the implications of what's going on, not necessarily what's happening on a minute-by-minute basis. Excuse me. But if they have sufficient information, we try to translate it in a manner that everybody can understand the implications of an event that's reported. So we're sort of being an interpretive, providing an interpretive service right now, but we're not on the ground and can't speak any better than the secretary in that regard.
And that is the voice of Ellen Vanko. She's Nuclear Energy and Climate Change Project Manager at the Union of Concerned Scientists. NG Howard, can you tell us how old these nuclear reactors are?
The Unit 1 at Fukushima is close to 40 years old. It was one of the original plants that was built in Japan. Others were added over time, but the 1 through 3 are older units. But just like in the United States, I believe that the Japanese have maintained their plants well. They have, kept them up to standards, their regulatory standards, just as we do here in the United States.
Now, when you say kept them up to nuclear regulatory standards, have those standards changed over the years since they were first built?
Yes, for several reasons. First of all, we are a learning industry. And from the time of the Three Mile Island event in the United States, we have established in the U.S., and then also there is a World Association of Nuclear Operators that looks at not only design issues from a regulatory standpoint, but also how to continuously improve and learn from events that occur throughout the world. And today, we're doing just that same thing with the information that we know from Fukushima. We also have a very strong program in the United States that has been put in place since September 11 that has upgraded both the safety and the security of nuclear units in the United States.
So you're saying if a nuclear unit were to be built today, it would be under very different standards from those built 40 years ago?
Well, the new designs today do have additional safety, and some of them have safety systems that don't require electricity don't require a lot of power or a lot of pumps, operating more off of gravity, you know, for some of the safety systems to flow water into the facilities, or have redundancies in their safety systems and in their containment. So you have new designs today, but the existing plants that we have today also meet the current regulatory standards, and we're continually assessing those to make sure that they are adequate to protect public health and safety.
How serious do you regard this particular situation in Japan?
Well, I think it's quite serious, and the industry is trying to assist the Japanese both technically and in humanitarian needs. I mean, this area of Japan has been hit with a historic earthquake and tsunami that has done massive damage throughout the area and the displacement of many people. Clearly, the situation at Fukushima has added to that. There's no question about that. And yet, from the knowledge that we have and the operational activities that the Japanese have taken, they took quick action to move people out, to take the evacuation moves so that they can further protect the public.
We are going to take a short break now. When we come back, we'll talk about further efforts to cool the core of these nuclear reactors, to cover the sites with water. I'm told that older technicians are now going in to try to deal with the situation there. Short break. We'll be right back. Welcome back. Joining us now is Chip Pardee. He's Chief Operating Officer of Exelon Generation, the country's largest owner and operator of nuclear power plants. He's based in Illinois. Good morning to you, sir. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning, Diane. My pleasure.
I wonder, Chip, do you believe that what's happened at Japan's Fukushima plants could happen at any one of Exelon's plants?
Well, Diane, no, I don't. And there are some decided reasons for that, which I can elaborate upon if you're interested.
Sure.
But there are a number of reasons why. You know, our plants in the United States, obviously, including Exelon's plants, are considerably different than those that are experiencing the challenges that they are in Japan. There were a number of similarities when they were initially designed and constructed, but since the 70s, the industry in the United States has continued to upgrade the regulatory framework in which we operate. Our operator training programs have been updated to include events such as this. Our emergency preparedness activities have been expanded upon and trained upon, you know, through the decades. And those are very significant differences in how we operate our power plants, how we plan for the worst event, and therein lies the basis of my answer.
And with the prospects that California could eventually have one of these devastating seismic effects, what is the condition of the nuclear power plants in California? What would be the result of a similar catastrophe there?
I will have to be careful. I can't speak definitively to the design requirements of the California plants that you're referring to, but I can certainly say that they are designed for catastrophic events such as earthquakes and tsunamis. The NRC has very recently reviewed the seismic and tsunami requirements, and those requirements are constantly being reviewed and as circumstances necessitate, upgraded. So as recently as, for example, 2009, the NRC issued a report on tsunami effects with judgment as to whether or not we were sufficiently protected in the domestic U.S. nuclear business. And I think from all we can see that our design criteria and the training that we do with the operators and the emergency preparedness staff would separate our response from what the Japanese folks are having to deal with today. And I should have started my conversation with our sympathies to the Japanese industry people that are having to deal with this and the nation as a whole. This is a catastrophic circumstances.
Indeed.
Everyone recognizes with the tsunami and the challenges.
Chip, I understand that Exelon sent lobbyists to Washington this week. What are they saying?
Well, the only lobbyist that I'm aware of was me, to be honest with you, Diane. I went to Washington earlier this week to speak on behalf of the industry. One of the roles that I fulfill is the chairman of the Nuclear Energy Institute's organization that is all of the chief nuclear officers in the United States. So I went on behalf of the industry to speak to elected officials and other interested parties to provide to the very best of my ability facts and perspectives regarding what was happening in Japan and our positioning here in the United States.
Did you actually help to run those briefings?
Yes. I was one of the principal speakers at those briefings.
I understand that that Exelon has spent nearly $4 million in lobbying and nearly $2 million through its PAC in 2010. Tell me what you hope to accomplish.
I'm sorry, just for clarity, what I hope to accomplish this week or in general what we do with our political action?
In the latter, please, and what that money is going for now.
Our political action committees are focused largely on information sharing with regard to climate change, with regard to EPA regulations that are being proposed. They are actually not focused principally on the nuclear business. It's more focused on energy and the need for a clean and green portfolio and comprehensive energy policy here in the United States.
Okay, and considering what's happened in Japan, do you think the U.S. should go forward with nuclear power?
I think that the United States should go forward cautiously with nuclear power. There are clearly going to be lessons learned for us from the events that are unfolding in Japan. Ever since the accident at Three Mile Island in the 1970s, the industry has been very aggressive about learning from and changing as a result of world events. And this will be another world event that I'm sure our industry will be more robust for. But with that said, there's going to be a balance of caution, making sure we're learning from this event. And yet, as best we can tell, there's nothing that has thus far transpired that would lead me to the conclusion that we shouldn't do anything, we shouldn't proceed on a different course.
And Chip Pardee is Chief Operating Officer of Exelon Generation. That's the country's largest owner and operator of nuclear power plants. Based in Illinois, they're all but one of Exelon's 10 nuclear plants are located in Illinois and Pennsylvania. The other is in New Jersey. Now, Charles Ferguson, who's president of the Federation of American Scientists, has a question for you, Chip.
Good morning, Charles.
Good morning, Chip. How are you?
I'm well. Nice to talk to you again.
You as well. For full disclosure, I admit that I do have own some shares in Exelon. But, Chip, my question to you is, a couple weeks ago in Washington, D.C., at the American Enterprise Institute, John Rowe, the CEO of Exelon, he was very clear. He said it's such a competitive business right now for nuclear because of low natural gas prices and abundant sources of natural gas. It seems that Mr. Rowe, even though he's still very pro-nuclear power, he's saying that it's probably not going to move forward in the United States because of where natural gas is right now. And in addition, I'd like you to comment on the Oyster Creek nuclear power plant in New Jersey, why Exelon is going to phase out operation of that plant in 2019, a full 10 years before its license renewal expires.
Okay, I'll start with your first question, Charles. John Rowe's comments, I believe, were not that nuclear power will not progress in the United States. It's that the merchant marketplace, the marketplace in where there is no regulatory structure backing up, you know, the construction costs and such of the nuclear power plants. In those merchant power plants, I think that progress will be slow, and this event in Japan may slow it down yet additionally. And that is simply because the opportunity to recapture costs in the uncertainties of a merchant marketplace may not support the very high initial upfront costs. And it's no different than what you're seeing us do with our proposed station down on the Texas Gulf Coast. We had originally stated the intent to build a dual-unit station down there when it became clear that natural gas prices were not going to support those construction costs. We have decided to go and establish a site but not pursue any construction activities until such time that it does appear that the marketplace would support that kind of upfront investment. There are others, for example, the Southern Company, and I don't want to speak too extensively to their strategy, but by all I can tell, the Southern Company and the Georgia Public Utility Commission is very interested in energy diversity and the long-term assuredness of a clean energy supply. And my belief is, again, from all the information I have, that they are continuing to proceed with their project there.
All right. Alan Vanko of the Union of Concerned Scientists has a question.
Diane, I did not complete Charles's questions. Shall we the Oyster Creek question?
Okay, later? Go ahead.
Okay. Charles, to your question about Oyster Creek, that also was one simply of economics. It appeared to us that we were going to be required by the state of New Jersey to install cooling towers there, and the economics associated with the installation of cooling towers with the plant lifetime that we had remaining before us, even with license extension at Oyster Creek, was not sufficient to support the costs of those cooling towers. Mm-hmm. So we had an agreement with the Christie administration to limit the remaining life of the plant in exchange for an agreement not to have to build cooling towers.
Interesting.
It was no more complicated than that.
But tell me about the situation between now and then without those cooling towers.
We have technology installed at Oyster Creek to limit the amount of entrainment and impingement impact to the local estuaries and Barnegat Bay. So we think that our impact on the Barnegat Bay is minimal, but if the decision is on the part of the state that they would like to require either cooling towers or to strike a deal with us to shorten the lifetime of the plant, then we did what we thought was best given the environment in the state of New Jersey and our responsibility to our shareholders.
Chip Pardee, he's Chief Operating Officer for Exelon Generation, the nation's largest owner and operator of nuclear plants based in Illinois. And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. And now to Ellen Vanko.
Thank you, Diane. Good morning, Chip. I also was at the American Enterprise Institute last week when John Rose spoke about the his view of the outlook of the nuclear power industry. And what he very clearly said, and it's in a speech posted on your website, so anybody listening to me can go look at it for themselves. But what he basically said was, first, do no harm. And the interesting thing is that last week, that phrase had a very different meaning than it has today. Last week, he was talking about economic harm. He did not view the building of new reactors as an economic activity that he had any intention of pursuing. His statement said that he would see maybe 3 to 4 units built before the end of the decade, maybe, and maybe nothing in the next decade. And he said this solely because he felt that the economics of natural gas would be more competitive and result in lower energy prices. He also mentioned energy efficiency as a significant significantly economic option, as well as uprates to your existing plants. I frankly didn't disagree with the thing Mr. Rose said in an almost hour-long speech. So it was very telling. But now I look at the speech a little differently when I see first do no harm. Do you think he would use that title again, but with a very different focus?
Well, I certainly can't speculate entirely to what John is thinking. I can tell you that I have the clear responsibility to assure John and the board and our shareholders that our operating units are safe. And this is a twice daily conversation with John as the events continue to unfold in Japan. So while I understand your question, thus far we are working very hard with the industry and other technical experts, and we continue to challenge ourselves on the ongoing safety of our units. And John very clearly holds us accountable to be able to provide that assuredness, and that's exactly what we're doing.
All right. Thank you so much for joining us, Chip Pardee. He's Chief Operating Officer for Exelon Generation. Thanks again.
And you're welcome,
turning
Diane,
to you now, Charles, the NRC has warned U.S. citizens in Japan to evacuate within a 50-mile radius of the plant. Now the U.S. is sending planes to evacuate those who wish to leave Japan, while 50 workers at the plant are still trying to cool down, to put water in, knowing it's a suicide mission.
Well, Diane, I'm not quite sure it's a suicide mission. I don't know if I want to use that term. And I've also heard terms like skeleton crew used in the newspapers. And this is such a serious time right now. I would just advise all of us to be careful with that kind of language. But it's my understanding that it's more than 50 workers. They're rotating in workers to try to minimize radiation exposure. And if things get worse, perhaps it could be a suicide-type mission. But I think it's not quite like the Chernobyl nuclear power plant accident in 1986, which happened about 25 years ago, in which we saw over 30 emergency workers putting their lives at risk. They knew that. It was a suicide mission for them. It's still not clear at this stage whether it's a suicide mission yet for those workers at Fukushima.
Older workers are going in, and the statement made last night was that they felt that these older workers would die of old age before they died of radiation poisoning, but they knew that they were putting their lives at risk. Short break. We'll be right back.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by Novo Nordisk. Since 1923, innovative developer of diabetes treatments and delivery devices at novonordisk-us.com. By the William and Flora Hewlett Foundation, making grants to solve social and environmental problems at home and around the world, on the web at hewlett.org. And by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. This is NPR.
The story of an Afghan woman who defied the odds under Taliban rule, how she started a dressmaking business, employed more than 100 women, and saved her family in the process. The Diane Rehm Show, next hour. Welcome back. It's time to open the phones, 800-433-8850. First to Truro, Massachusetts. Good morning, Richard. You're on the air.
Yeah, hi. Thank you. I want to say, first of all, that I don't think it's possible for there to be such a thing as safe nuclear power, and largely because the first thing that happens is that uranium has to be taken out of the ground. It's an intensely dangerous operation. And it's usually poor people. In this country, it's usually Native Americans in the Southwest who suffer enormous health consequences from mining uranium. I don't hear it discussed very often, but it should be the first line of discussion any time anyone's talking about nuclear power and if it could possibly be safe. Because if you can't supply the fuel safely, regardless of all the other issues, it can't possibly be a safe way to generate energy.
All right, Angie.
Thank you, and thank you for your question. First of all, we have to look at every energy source as having some risk and some benefits. And the existing plants today in the United States are operating and providing safe and reliable power. As you talk about uranium mining, though, it's important to do it correctly. And in the early days, where we were developing a weapons program in the United States, we did do some mining that perhaps was not done with the best environmental concerns in mind. Today, that is much different around the world, with mines that are operated in Canada, in Australia, and in other places in the world. So I think the mining industry has changed significantly. But I also would like to remind the listener that we have an agreement with Russia on taking blended down nuclear weapons. So weapons that once were pointed at the United States are now providing fuel for our reactors here. Roughly half of the uranium that's used in our plants today is coming from blended down nuclear weapons. And so it's clearly a benefit from a world standpoint.
All right, let's go to Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. Good morning, Mike.
Good morning. How are you all today?
I'm fine.
Hey,
thank you.
I wanted to talk about the safety factor. You know, I live near Three Mile Island, and I remember very well. It would seem to me common sense that we don't build nuclear plants on top of active fault lines. We wouldn't be talking about this if there hadn't been the tsunami. I think that the reactor in Japan, those reactors would have been fine.
Okay, Mike, I'm afraid we're losing you, but I certainly get the impact of your message. Charles?
I agree we shouldn't build nuclear plants
on active fault lines.
Right. Well, I studied, actually, nuclear earthquakes on my doctorate in physics at Boston University. I'm not a geophysicist by training, but I studied strikes at faults like in California, and it's a very complex science. We can't predict earthquakes. We could try to forecast like we do with weather.
No, I understand that, but certainly near fault lines
right.
makes the possibility or the prospect of damage and severe damage that much greater.
Look at Japan. Japan has these trade-offs. They feel that they are energy insecure. Go back to the Arab oil embargo in 1973. At that time, Japan was using generating electricity from two-thirds of it from oil and very dependent on foreign oil because it didn't have source of oil and or coal or natural gas domestically. So the trade-off seemed to be that go more into nuclear. Of course, longer term, I think they should go more into renewables, wind and solar and geothermal, but it takes a long time to ramp up those sources.
Yeah.
I just wanted to interject something I learned yesterday. It's not something I knew, and that is that a number of the plants that are located on faults today, those faults were found after the plants were built and sited, interestingly. Not every one. It's not that somebody said, oh, here's a fault, let's build on it, but in effect, that's what happened. They just found out after the fact.
Angie.
Well, and in fact, that's part of the reason that we continually look and provide upgrades, both from a regulatory perspective, as Chip mentioned, to 2009 NRC report looked at upgrades that might be needed. But again, I think you also have to look at, we do know a lot about engineering for ground movement and earthquake protection. We've seen that in construction of buildings. And I would also suggest that your listeners also look at the geologic conditions that here, even in the United States, are much different than what we have in Japan.
Now, we do have China and Switzerland delaying their plans for new plants. Germany has temporarily shut down older responses, older reactors. What do you think's going to happen around the world?
I'm not sure I can speak to what's going to happen around the world. I'm pretty focused on what's going to happen here and what is happening in Japan. And what I think is going to happen here is we're going to have a lot of lessons learned. I agree with Angie and I agree with Chip that the industry spends an awful lot of time trying to learn from what it might have done wrong and improve systems based on new information and new technology. But this learning is going to take time. We don't know all the lessons we're going to learn from Japan. So number one, we shouldn't presume we know everything. Nobody should ever say it can't happen here. We may not have a 6.0 or a 9.0 magnitude earthquake followed by a massive tsunami. And so, when you say it can't happen here, it may only be right in the sense that the conditions and the impacts would be different.
Are you all, however, saying that there is no way to construct a completely safe nuclear reactor?
Well, Diane, that's a great question. I addressed that in my book, Nuclear Energy, What Everyone Needs to Know. It's a question of, should we have a zero tolerance policy on nuclear safety? I used to work at the U.S. State Department Office of Nuclear Safety, and the philosophy there and among regulatory agencies and industry is that a nuclear accident anywhere is a nuclear accident everywhere. It's with an allusion to Martin Luther King Jr.'s speech from Letter from Birmingham Jail. But the view is that we're all in the same boat. If there's a major accident anywhere in the world, it can affect the whole global industry. But is that too stringent of a standard? So I do hear some people in the industry now saying, well, even if we experience something like a worst-case accident here in Japan, and it ends up being not that bad in terms of the human health perspective, maybe ultimately that's good for the industry because it shows the industry could recover from a worst-case event and to demonstrate to people that the tsunami killed far more people than the nuclear accident.
Diane, I'd like to just make a comment as well. Nothing is 100% safe, nothing in the world that we do. And if we look at and are serious about our air quality and climate change and protecting our the air that we breathe, we need more clean energy. We need to develop the renewables. We need to develop clean coal technologies, but we also need
to... There is no such thing as a clean coal
technology. Well, we're looking very hard. Well, I'm not going to get into the... We're talking about nuclear, but the industry and the government are looking at ways of removing carbon, and we also do remove some of those. But if we don't use nuclear at 20% baseload power, generating it without emitting greenhouse gases and controlled pollutants, the impact on public and health and safety will be even greater.
All right, let's go to Ann Arbor, Michigan, and to Alan. Good morning to you.
Good morning, Diane.
I'm sorry, sir. If you're on a speakerphone,
I can barely hear you.
Thank you.
Good morning, Diane.
Good morning.
This is... could be the worst calamity ever, blowing in the wind, unfolding in slow motion, particularly in this Unit 3 reactor. There is a plutonium fuel, this mixed oxide fuel. It's a crime against humanity that plutonium is put in a place where it could be dispersed. Would you have your people talk about the plutonium, its poisonousness, that the plume coming out of there hits the United States tomorrow?
Well, Diane, I've actually been to the plutonium facility in Japan about 3.5 years ago, the Rakkashō facility, and it seemed, just taking a day-long tour there, it's very professionally run, very, very clean, very secure. However, the concerns are that Japan is sitting on a big stockpile of separated plutonium that could potentially be used to make nuclear weapons. So that makes the Chinese nervous, to say the least. And so Japan is very much a latent nuclear weapon state. In addition, your caller raises a concern that if there's a severe accident, a rupture at Unit 3 that uses this plutonium mixed oxide fuel, that the health hazards could be greater. And that is a concern. I'm not saying it's very likely to happen, but it's something that it does call into question the use of plutonium in these fuels.
Ellen, where are the greatest risks in this country?
The greatest risks come from people who are not operating the reactors as safely and securely as they can, and who have not evaluated them for the best way to ensure.
And how often are they evaluated?
Well, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission regularly evaluates a very small percentage of events.
What percentage?
It's my understanding that it's about 5%. So if you have 1,000 incidents, they may investigate 50. And as a matter of fact, the Union of Concerned Scientists has had a report in the works for about 6 to 8 months now that specifically looks at the Nuclear Regulatory's safety oversight performance in 2010. This has been done by our nuclear safety expert, Dave Lockbaum. And at 11 o'clock today, we will be releasing this report to the public. And it's titled The NRC and Nuclear Power Plant Safety in 2010.
And its conclusions?
Basically, what it concludes is that the NRC has found a series of, well, Dave looked at 14 special inspections that the NRC launched that affect troubling events at the plant, safety equipment problems, and security shortcomings. And the report provides an overview of each one of these. And the overview shows that many of these significant events occurred because reactor owners and often the NRC tolerated known safety problems. The report not only points to three oversight activities that the NRC performed very well and actually prevented more significant events from happening. So it's not that the NRC is not capable and doesn't have the people to do the job it's supposed to do, but the report also finds, examines three specific events where the NRC could have done a better job. I can't really go into the details of it. Like I said, we're going to have a press conference and release this report in a couple minutes, and a lot more details will be available by then.
And Angie, the question for you would be how much self-regulation is going on at these power plants?
Well, I would also like to add that every nuclear power plant has NRC resident inspectors that work at those stations, and they're there, many of them on multiple shifts during the plant. So you have resident inspectors from the Nuclear Regulatory Commission
at every plant. How does that jibe with what you just said?
Well, I think what Ellen was saying is they looked at specific events that occurred at plants and were trying to learn from that and how
what
the
kinds
NRC,
of events.
Well, I haven't seen the report.
What kinds of events?
There are many things that occur at a nuclear plant that are done by many, many people every minute of every day. So it could be something as simple as leaving a rag on the floor. It could be a water
leak. But
surely,
we're not talking about leaving rags on floors.
But I think the important thing to come back to, you asked about the industry self-regulation. The industry does have, through the Institute of Nuclear Power Operations, an evaluation, a very detailed, in-depth evaluation of the operations, also of training. And there's a program to review all of these types of events that Ellen is mentioning, very minor events, to see if there's something that we can learn from them and share that information.
I'd like to understand exactly how minor these are.
Not all of them are minor, Diane. Roof leaks, shorting out electrical equipment, security problems that would have allowed people to enter the plant that, or did allow people to enter the plant that should have without appropriate clearances, pumps that malfunction, valves that stick open when they should be closed or closed when they should be open. I mean, there are very real events, and luckily for us, none of them have led to a negative consequence yet, but they're occurring.
All right, and to Norman in Palm City, Florida, you're on the air.
Yes, hello, Diane.
Yes, go right ahead, sir.
You know, the reactors did their job. They did not react to the they did not react negatively to the earthquake. Now, tsunami is a Japanese word. They know a lot about tsunamis. Now, considering all of this, why were the reactors built so close to the shoreline? Couldn't the reactors have been built further inland, just 5 to 10 miles, so that they could have escaped the damage of the tsunami.
Charles.
Well, it's a matter of convenience. Having nuclear power plants right on the coast near available seawater, it's a great cooling system, the Pacific Ocean. On the other hand, they had a seawall as well to prevent a tsunami wave coming in. But the wave that came in exceeded the seawall height. This is such an extraordinary event. It was off the charts historically. But I think what we should be asking a question about is the emergency diesel generators. Why were they located where they were, that they were susceptible to this kind of damage from flooding, from the tsunami? That points to perhaps a safety error, an error in the plant design.
Angie, I know you were at Three Mile Island a week after that disaster. What do you remember from being there?
Probably most in what made the biggest impression on me was that I was in the Unit 2 building and in the control room. I did not receive any radiation. I did have radiation dosimetry on me, and that as serious and as damaged as the fuel was, and at that time we did not know how much it was damaged, I didn't receive any radiation, and I was in the control room at Unit 2, and people were working there.
Angie Howard, she's former executive with the Nuclear Energy Institute, Ellen Vanko of the Nuclear Energy and Climate Change Project Manager at the Union of Concerned Scientists, and Charles Ferguson, President of the Federation of American Scientists. Thank you all so much. And thanks for listening. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Susan Neighbors, Denise Couture, Monique Nazareth, and Sarah Ashworth. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dory Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives, transcripts, podcasts, and CD sales. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow.org, and we're on Facebook and Twitter. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. This is NPR.